It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Still ahead, we'll take a closer look at a 6-year plan to expand services to domestic abuse victims here in Wisconsin.
First, by now you've probably seen hundreds of people dump ice-cold buckets of water on their heads as part of the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. The challenge was created by the ALS Association to spread awareness and raise money for research on the disease, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease.
The idea is that each person nominated for the challenge films him or herself dumping a bucket of ice water on their head. They nominate 3 other people to do it, and then they put the film up on social media. To opt out of the cold soaking, the alternative, donate $100 to the ALS Association. A lot of people are doing both, the ice water challenge and the donation.
The tactic for spreading awareness and raising money is new in the world of social media, and it's become a sensation with celebrities, politicians, and friends from around the world joining in. Notables have ranged from Bill Gates and Kermit the Frog to Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke.
The association announced that since the launch of the challenge a month ago, they raised close to $95 million. While their challenge has been a success by many measures, some are criticizing the campaign as obscuring the real reasons to donate money to a charity. Scott Gilmore recently wrote the piece, Why the Ice Bucket Challenge is Bad for You. He's here with us now to talk about it. Scott is the CEO of Building Markets, a nonprofit that invests in entrepreneurs in developing countries. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So what is wrong with the Ice Bucket Challenge? How does it steer us in the wrong direction?
Well, the Ice Bucket Challenge is a brilliant way to raise money, but it's a horrible reason to donate it. When people decide that they're going to spend their finite amount of resources on a charity, they have to ask themselves why they're doing it and what's the best way for them to spend that money. And just because there's a viral video is not a good reason to do so.
Well, is this, do you think, taking away from money that might have been donated somewhere else, or is it getting people to donate a little more than they might have in the entirety of their annual giving?
You know, that's a really good question to ask. The short answer is we don't know. There is some evidence to suggest that when you have viral campaigns like this, that at least 50% of the money would have gone to other donors. And so on a campaign of this scale, where it's now $95 million or probably over $100 million, that's a lot of money that may have gone to other charities that may have helped more people.
So you want us to think about giving in a different way, not latching on to a fun campaign, whatever it may be for, but thinking it through a little more. How do we set our priorities in our, as you say, finite giving dollars?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is you have to figure out what's important for yourself, and then you have to ask yourself 3 questions. So to begin with, you say, am I interested in culture? Do I want to support health? Is it animals? Once you've picked your cause, then the 3 questions you have to ask yourself is, where is the greatest need? So, for example, if you say you want to help people, is it on medical research or is it on disease prevention? Then the second question you ask yourself is, where can my money have the greatest influence? Is there a particular charity that is doing amazing things and desperately needs money, or is there a particular issue that I can support? And then the third question you ask yourself is, where's the most urgent need in this cause? So, for example, if there's a humanitarian crisis, frequently they need donor money right away, and that's something to take into consideration.
Now, when you look at ALS in the piece you wrote, you're not saying, you know, it's not a worthy cause, it's not worthy of some charity funding. What you are saying is that if we weighed our donations in this way, the ALS might not jump to the top of our list. We might put our money elsewhere.
Exactly. You know, I think the ALS is a horrible disease, and I think the ALS organization should be commended for how effective they've been in bringing attention to it. What I'm criticizing is the donors. You know, we need to put more thought into where we spend our money. Right now, we take more time to consider where we're going to order takeout than where we're going to make a donation.
So how do we start doing that? How do we change our mindset of as donors, large scale or small?
Think of it as an investment. You know, when you invest money, you don't just immediately give it to whoever's knocking on your front door. You think about, what do I want to change? What impact do I want to have with my investment? And that's the exact same thing we should do with donations. So, you know, just do a little bit of research. Google the issue. Take a look at the charity's website. Read their annual report. It sounds like a lot of work, but it's not. It takes a couple of minutes, and it's so important. And I think once you do that, once your listeners do that, not only will they realize that they're having a bigger impact with their money, but they'll end up doing a lot more donating.
On the particular point of donating our money where it's effective, it seems like that might be one of the hardest things to weigh. Is it the most effective to donate, if we're interested in the medical issue, to the group doing research in a cure or research on prevention or a local group or a national group? How do you sort out how your money has an impact?
You know, there's no short answer on that. It depends on the issue. So, for example, take malaria. Right now, there actually has been quite a bit of money spent on researching a vaccine for malaria, and one's about to be tested. And so donating that might not be the best thing, but donating to prevention of malaria, that might make more sense. The answer is going to be different for every issue and for every charity, and so I would just encourage your listeners, do some investigating. Find out how much they spend on overhead. Where do they operate? How much are they spending on raising money, and how much are they spending on the things that they claim to actually do?
Well, there's something clearly powerful here. Social media has a lot of people donating money to this one particular cause, the ALS research. Is there a way to use social media to provoke the maybe more thoughtful process that you're thinking about?
Well, I would hope so. And in fact, the conversation that's now taking place about the Ice Bucket Challenge is an example of that. There is a lot of debate that's now happening in the last few days that wasn't happening a week ago about these very issues. A lot of people are talking about and asking the exact same questions. And so if it started a conversation about ALS, the Ice Bucket Challenge has also started a conversation about the effectiveness of how we support charities.
You know, the social media is the new thing. It used to be, you know, when a cause landed a big celebrity, that could draw a lot of attention, maybe a lot of donations. Is there a way we can take the heat off of the organizations doing the work themselves so that they don't have to worry so much about coming up with the next celebrity or the next marketing trick that they depend on to raise their money?
I would hope so. You know, one of the messages I'm trying to get across to people is that if it takes a viral video or if it takes a silly mustache or some other gimmick to get you to open up your wallet and make a donation, then you should be a little bit ashamed of yourselves. I mean, we all have a responsibility to contribute to our society and contribute to our community through charitable acts, and whether it's through volunteering or through money, and you shouldn't have to be given a gimmick or a fad to encourage you to do that.
So I read through some of the reactions, the comments in your initial piece, people upset, making it out as though you were criticizing the work of this charity on the one hand. At worst, at best, you're kind of a buzzkill a little bit. How do you respond to the responses you've gotten?
Well, my article had an overwhelming response. I think it's had over a million readers so far. And the majority of them, I think, are supportive. But those that are opposed to my view are very, very emotional about it. I mean, oftentimes, they know people who've suffered from ALS, for example. And I can understand where that emotion comes from. But, you know, I'm not criticizing the charity, and I'm not suggesting ALS necessarily is an unworthy cause. I'm criticizing ourselves and saying we need to think more about how we do it. And one point that's been raised by a lot of people is that if I had a family member, God forbid, who had ALS, that I would probably be singing a different tune. And I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's a valid reason to give to any charity. Is it because it matters to you personally or matters to the people you love? But for most of us, we need to think about what we're trying to do. ALS is a rare disease. Thankfully, it's only going to affect very few of us in North America. But there are other diseases like heart disease and cancer, which affect millions of people. And we can't forget those. And we have to think about where are we going to have the greatest impact for society.
All in all, though, Ice Bucket Challenge or no, you're hoping people become more philanthropical as we move ahead.
I'm hoping. You know, one of the great things about the social media explosion over the last decade is that people are much, much more aware of the suffering of others, whether it's ALS sufferers in their own neighborhood or the suffering of, you know, black or African kids in countries like Nigeria. So it makes us more empathetic, and it makes us realize all the challenges they're facing in the world, and hopefully that'll lead us to more donations.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That was Scott Gilmore. He's CEO of Building Markets. He's been talking about what to consider when we donate to a charity.
The Governor's Council on Domestic Abuse released a long-range plan yesterday to provide more resources to victims of domestic violence here in Wisconsin.
According to the council, just over 2,000 victims and children receive help from victim service programs every day. They also say about 250 requests for help go unmet because local agencies don't have the necessary resources.
Tony Gibbert is with us. He's the public policy coordinator for End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, and he's worked closely with the council on this report. Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's get a handle on the people in Wisconsin who are being affected by domestic abuse and violence. What do the statistics show about who's being affected?
Well, we know that it's a statewide problem and that it reaches all areas of our state. The statistics show that over 700,000 Wisconsin women at one point in their life have been victims of domestic violence. So when you think about that number, it's larger than the populations of Milwaukee and Green Bay combined. So whether we realize it or not, whether we know it or not, we all know at least one person and probably many people who have been affected by this epidemic throughout our state.
And what kinds of resources are there for someone who has been the victim of domestic violence?
Well, the good news is that there are service providers and agencies across the state. Every county in Wisconsin has either a shelter or a service provider that works with victims in that community. And so those resources and support really can be life-saving, and they make a difference for the victims they reach. Our goal with the plan is to make sure that every victim and every child, really, who's exposed to domestic violence has the opportunity to receive those services and that those services meet their needs.
And you point out that it's women being affected, but it's also children. So it's a family effect here that's going on. How does it affect children?
Well, you know, and I should say, this is an issue that affects women primarily. When we look at the numbers, there really is a gendered nature to the issue of domestic violence, but that's not to say that some men aren't also affected and also victims. So it's important to point out, when we paint the picture of how this impacts lives, there is that aspect to it, but we want to be clear that services are available for men as well as women. But getting to your question, children are impacted in a variety of ways, and that impact is different on a case-by-case basis. But children who grow up in abusive homes, that has a real impact on their lives. It has an impact on how they perceive relationships as they grow into adulthood. It can impact their ability to learn and to be educated and to be their most productive as they grow. And those children, the facts show, are at increased risk for abuse to themselves personally. So there is a multi-layer to the impact that they experience.
Now, the long-range plan is going into place, and it's intended to help meet some of these needs that are going unmet right now. People aren't getting the services they need. Where are the biggest needs right now?
Well, one thing that the plan shows, and the statistics that Rob mentioned, is that the need, first and foremost, is to make sure that core services to victims are available. And that includes both the crisis response services that some folks might be familiar with, emergency shelter, counseling, some basic legal information and advocacy, but also addressing the longer term needs of victims so that they can achieve self-sufficiency and stay safe and stay independent of abusers. So that includes services to address financial abuse and make sure that they have the resources they need for housing and financial stability, to address the longer-term effects of trauma, but then also to make sure that we have services throughout Wisconsin that really speak to victims and can address their unique cultural situations, and that every victim and every survivor feels comfortable coming forward to an advocate who that they feel understands them and to which they can relate.
So you mentioned reaching out to different ethnic groups involved here. Are there particular groups that you want to reach out to who have a need that might be harder to reach in through traditional means?
Well, I wouldn't say there's one particular group or even several particular groups, but I think when you think about it, that talking about domestic violence really is very difficult for anyone, that those are intimate, very painful details. And so someone who comes from a particular cultural group, necessarily would want to disclose to someone who that they feel at least has a good chance of understanding them, understanding their background, understanding their culture, understanding their values. So to reach every victim, every survivor, every child, it's important that the services throughout the state give victims that opportunity.
And for a long time, there's been a culture of shame around domestic abuse. It's one of the biggest hurdles is getting people to come forward and say that they need help. And, you know, you can go into bathrooms sometimes, women's rooms, and see signs about abuse, or in doctor's offices. Is that a culture that you see shifting, that it's becoming more acceptable and okay to step forward and say that you need help because you're in an abusive situation, whoever you are.
I definitely do think that as a movement, we've made progress in expanding the public conversation about domestic violence. But, you know, victims still report that even if they know about services that are available, it's sometimes a struggle to access them. We had a survivor with us to release the plan here in Madison, and she actually mentioned that she saw a pamphlet for her local service provider in a women's room. But because she was in a very rural community, very isolated, she didn't have transportation to get to the agency, and that agency didn't actually have an emergency shelter. So that is what she needed. She needed an emergency shelter, and it wasn't available in her community. So it took several more incidents before she finally felt that she was able and that the situation was severe enough that she was able to leave.
Now, shelters are a piece of the puzzle here that you're working on. How do we get more accessible shelters to a greater number of people who need them?
Well, shelters are, as you mentioned, one piece of the puzzle. And we have seen communities across the state really invest a lot of time and resources in making sure that they are contributing to making sure that those services are available. For example, here in Dane County, DAIS, Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, recently opened its new shelter. The Racine Women's Resource Center kicked off its capital campaign for a new shelter in western Racine County, a more rural area, yesterday, in fact. And Manitowoc is expanding its shelter, and they kicked off their capital campaign a couple of weeks ago. So one thing that the report demonstrates, and it relates to the conversation you just had with your last guest, is that individuals, private companies, really do step up and do support a lot of the investment in victim services. About half of the resources that go to supporting domestic violence victims in the state of Wisconsin come from non-governmental sources. And so continuing that momentum and making sure that communities understand that this is an issue and continue to invest in making sure that all victims are protected and have shelter is definitely a huge part of what we're trying to do.
And along with that, you know, obviously education is a big piece of what you're doing. What do you think needs to be done to educate whole communities about domestic violence?
Right. Well, domestic violence shelters and service providers, the advocates that work with victims, really are the experts in their communities about this issue. And what we really need to do is make sure that they are empowered to lead their communities. Once people are talking about this issue, they can be part of the solution. Domestic violence is obviously a social issue that feeds off of the beliefs and attitudes of those who perpetrate domestic violence. And we need to think about how, over the long term, we're going to change as a society and as communities to shift those attitudes and beliefs. And so when you're working in crisis situations to respond to the emergency life and death needs of victims, it's very difficult to have that broader view. But we want to make sure that advocates have the resources so that they can do that and that we can eventually make it so that there isn't a need for domestic violence shelters in the state of Wisconsin.
So educating people and changing beliefs, systems of beliefs and attitudes is a tough nut to crack. How do you begin doing that?
Well, the most effective work that can be done in that regard is with the next generation. So making sure that we're reaching out to youth and teens and really fostering a sense of what healthy relationships look like so that they don't grow up with the attitudes and beliefs that have allowed domestic violence to continue. And there's a lot of exciting work that's being done in schools and with educators to shift those attitudes and beliefs to encourage teens to think about their values and to think about what healthy relationships look like. And that's something that the plan calls for, is we want to see more of that in the state of Wisconsin, because with all of the competing things that go on in a classroom, often educators and teachers don't get to do that important work, and we'd like to see more of that happen.
Well, right now we're talking with Tony Gibbert of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. The group, along with the Governor's Council on Domestic Abuse, have released a long-range plan for maintaining and expanding services to abuse victims. And we're talking right now about that plan, what it entails, and what needs to be done to move Wisconsin forward in providing more services to victims.
And we invite you to join the conversation. What more do you think could be done to help domestic abuse survivors here in Wisconsin? Have you turned to these types of services in the past? What did you find? Was it enough? Was it something you could use? Have you worked in providing these services, now or in the past? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
We're talking about Wisconsin's long-term plan to address domestic abuse in the state. Tony Gibbert is our guest. He's public policy coordinator with End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls. What types of services should be made available to victims of domestic abuse? What is the key, do you think, to ending domestic violence altogether? And do you know someone who's sought help in Wisconsin's system, or do you work in one of these service providers around the state? Love to hear your story. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org or comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to the phones now. We're going to take our first call from Michael in Green Bay. Hi, Michael.
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hey there. I was just wanting to have a comment on what you guys are addressing. I myself, personally, going through this domestic thing, find it very sad that being single and being a male and going through this, that there's nothing out there for me. I spent a lather of my 2 days looking for assistance, and I couldn't find anything. All I was told was I don't have children, I don't have a drug problem, I'm not an alcoholic. And so there's nothing for me. And I even went to a place where I volunteer called St. John's, and I asked them for assistance thinking, you know, since they help everybody else, maybe they can help me. And the girl who took my call named Abby said that she would get back to me, and then the next day she didn't. So I called her back, and she laughed and said, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot about you. And I told her, you know, that's not a laughing matter. You know, this is something important for me that you can forget about me when I'm one paycheck or two away from becoming homeless.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael. I'm sorry to hear about the troubles you're having. Michael is having trouble locating services. What does he need to know?
Well, I'd encourage Michael to go to our website, endabusewi.org, and click on the Get Help tab. There are a number of domestic violence victim service providers in the Fox Valley area, and those organizations do provide services to all individuals. If he wants to leave his contact information with the producer, I'd be happy to try to get him some help too. St. John's is an organization he mentioned, and I'm not familiar with it. So sometimes it's about knowing the right organizations to call. And so there's also the National Domestic Abuse Hotline. That's a good resource, one-stop shop, and that is 800-799-SAFE.
So are there any hurdles that you know of to partners, especially men in a same-sex couple who are being abused? Are there any hurdles to them getting the help that they need that you know of, or is this an instance of scarcity of resources?
There are a number of hurdles, and there are a number of unique hurdles for individuals who are in same-sex relationships. Just the stigma of homophobia that is still prevalent in our society is a hurdle to get over, because when a victim in a same-sex relationship is trying to reach out for help, they don't even necessarily know if the person that they're going to talk to is comfortable with their relationship, let alone addressing the domestic violence situation. So we want folks to know that the domestic violence service providers in the state of Wisconsin are available, that they do work with same-sex couples. And the a point of emphasis in the plan is to make sure that we do more outreach in that way, and that there are specific services for the LGBT community, because research shows that those individuals are more comfortable reaching out to an organization that they know is going to understand the unique barriers and issues that they face.
All right. Well, thank you and good luck to you, Michael. And we go next to Lynn, who joins us from Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. Someone very, very close to me is in a woman's shelter here in Eau Claire with her three children. She had to walk away from everything, and the little perpetrator is still out perpetrating. Recently, she's in Bolton House, Bolton Refuge House, one of them, and they took the washers and dryers out of the building that serviced four families that had to walk away from everything because of abuse, and that's further abuse. some of those women, one of the newer residents, has three or four children. English is not her first language, and at no access to a vehicle. Luckily, the young woman that I'm talking about has me and our family. And it's heinous to further take from women who have had to walk away from everything.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. And I'm glad that you're helping your friend and that she's in a safe house for now and she's got some resources there. But is what Lynn talking about some of the need that you're addressing with this plan to fund and provide, you know, services, not only the safe houses themselves and a secure place to live, but also access to amenities within those houses?
Definitely. And I'm not familiar with the specific issue at Bolton Refuge House, but certainly shelters and service providers are scraping by. And so I'm not surprised that there might be an issue of, you know, just being able to maintain some of the basic amenities that you would expect in a communal living situation. The caller mentioned transportation. As we kind of talked about, transportation issues for victims, even in, you know, a mid-sized city like Eau Claire, there are real barriers to being able to get to jobs, get to interviews, get to childcare and medical appointments. And so if a victim is escaping an abusive situation and the abuser is the one who has the car, that can put victims in a very, very difficult situation, just living financially independent away from the source of danger.
Now, one part of this that we haven't talked about yet is the legal aspect. What challenges are there for victims of domestic abuse legally?
So one thing that the plan emphasizes is the need for civil legal services for low-income victims of domestic violence. And this is an aspect of our state's response to domestic violence that often gets overlooked because we think about the law enforcement response. We think about the prosecution of crimes related to domestic violence. But we don't think about the fact that when the criminal proceedings are over, sometimes simultaneously, the victim and the perpetrator are often involved in family court. And when victims and perpetrators have children in common, really the decisions that are made in civil court, in family court, can be much more consequential for victims and their children, because family courts can order that victims and perpetrators have ongoing contact. So you can invest tons of resources in prosecuting the crime, tons of resources in trying to keep the victim and the perpetrator separated as part of the criminal justice system. But when victims walk into family court without an attorney that can help them assert their rights, they're often put right back into the crucible of domestic abuse. And so that's a real weakness in our state's response, that we don't invest in making sure that victims are protected and represented. Most states in the Midwest invest in that service. They spend on average over $7 million in civil legal services for low-income clients. Wisconsin spends $0. And so that's a real weakness, as I said, in our state's response to domestic violence.
And I want to get in an email from Judy here who says, shelters that take pets are needed. Families who must uproot themselves are traumatized again by having to leave behind a beloved pet, often to be abused or killed by the perpetrator. Humans aren't the only ones affected. An interesting point there. Is that something that's under consideration?
Yes, and it's something that shelters have worked on over the course of many years to try to develop programs so that pets and animals can be safe when victims leave abusive situations, particularly for victims who don't have children. Often their closest connection in the world, because they've been isolated and abused, is a beloved pet. And so to leave that home and leave the pet behind can be so painful, and sometimes it's a reason why victims stay in abusive relationships. And we know that abusers will sometimes use animals and pets as a way to send a message to victims, that they will abuse the pets or even kill the pets as a way to say to the victim that you're next, that I did this to the pet and I can do this to you. It's horrific, but it's the reality. And so Judy's comment is right on.
Well, as long as we're talking about it, homicide is another aspect of this, and some victims of domestic abuse become homicide victims. What sorts of What sorts of aspects here are we working with to try to prevent that? Mm-hmm. That's the most extreme case that you want to avoid at all costs. What do we do to keep that from happening?
Absolutely. And just looking at the homicide data, first and foremost, demonstrates that this is a statewide problem. 69 of Wisconsin's 72 counties have had a domestic violence homicide since 2000. That's the vast majority of our state. And what the plan calls for is utilizing our knowledge that we've been gaining about risk and lethality risk to give intensive services and outreach to victims who are most at risk. National studies show that only 4% of domestic violence homicide victims had contact with a domestic violence shelter or service provider. So on the one hand, that's really good news because it shows that when you reach out to a service provider, your risk of being involved in a domestic violence homicide goes down, thankfully. But it also shows that many victims are still isolated and don't have access to those resources. So working with law enforcement and other agencies or service providers that have contact with victims and have them evaluate risk and lethality and then refer those victims to more intensive services so we can break down that isolation that can be deadly is something that communities are starting to look at and that the plan encourages.
And before we let you go, if someone's listening and they're a victim of domestic abuse, they haven't reached out for help yet, what should their first step be?
Well, as I said, they can go to our website, endabusewi.org, and /get help, or click on the Get Help button, or they can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 1-800-799-SAFE.
1-800-799-SAFE. Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Tony Gibbert, Public Policy Coordinator at End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. He worked closely with the Governor's Council on Domestic Abuse, which released a long-range plan to provide more resources to victims here in Wisconsin.
Not to be a downer, but summer is ticking away. School starts next week for most students around the state. Labor Day is coming up. September is lurking. So what do you still want to do before summer's gone?
We want to hear from you right now at 800-642-1234. Is there a day trip that you wanted to make? Maybe a hike or just getting out on the lake in your boat one more time? Maybe a household chore, something not so fun, but something you really wanted to check off before summer was over? You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Also, how about that summer reading? Is there another book on your list that you're hoping to finish up? Or start, call 800-642-1234.
And maybe you're using Labor Day weekend to do one of these things. Tell us what you're going to try to check off before we say goodbye to summer. And we go to our callers now. Mike is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm going to work right now. I'm in the service industry, so I'll be spending the Labor Day weekend in the hot kitchen all weekend. I'm a student over at the technical system, too, and we actually started on Monday of this week.
Oh, so. They started you early. Well, did you get in a last summer thing before you were done?
Well, I went camping in the beginning of August, so I suppose that was getting close to the end of summer for me.
Did that feel like enough? Do you feel like you've done everything now, or do you have something else you want to do?
No, I think that was enough. I had a pretty leisurely summer. You know, just working and whatever, not really anything else. It wasn't bad. Plus, we get done with school really early. We get done in the beginning of May, so
yeah.
I guess that works. And then for summer reading, probably just catching up on my Star Wars. I'm really waiting for that movie to come around next year, and I know they're gonna erase. They have all these books out there for Star Wars, but I guess they're going to start up a whole new plot line when they make these new movies. So
right.
Saying goodbye to Jason and Hina and Luke and Mara and all those people. So.
Wow. So it should be interesting, something to catch up on there. And you can take that on into the fall. Fall is a cozy time to read, too. Well, Mike, glad you had a good summer, and thanks for calling.
Thank you.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you still want to do before summer is over? The book to read, the day trip, the hike, the job around the house, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We asked around the office here. Carl Christensen, a producer of Zorba, Pastor on Your Health.
And sometimes Central Time.
And sometimes Central Time, says, I'm hoping to clear the leaves and muck out of my gutters before the fall layer of leaves and muck starts to accumulate. So I think Carl's been putting that off
for a
while.
Yeah, I could have written that.
Yeah.
I've been working on getting our gutters cleaned all summer to no avail, but it seems like, well, no, fall's around the corner. We might as well wait till fall. But yeah, not the most exciting one. But Mike Crane, our boss here at Wisconsin Public Radio, says, right now headed to Vermont to do a century ride with longtime friends. Been doing it for at least 15 years to celebrate the end of summer.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah, getting in one last thing. There's something ceremonial, I think, about doing one more summery thing just to really squeeze the last drop of summer out of the last weekend of summer.
How are you squeezing the last bit of life out of your summer? 800-642-1234. What are you going to regret if you don't do it before September rolls around? Unfortunately, this is going to be another one of those summers where I think we don't make it to Devil's Lake during the summer.
Oh, yeah, we didn't go there
Can
either.
Can you believe it?
And
yeah,
we didn't make it to Governor Dodge, which was on my list, too.
Governor Dodge, we did hit this year.
All right, you got one up on me.
All right. We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Molly on the line in Appleton. Molly, hi.
Hi. I am calling to say that I like to take my daughter to the zoo during summer. And so this weekend, we are taking her to the zoo.
All right. And the zoo, that's an important part of your summer up there.
I'm sorry?
Is the zoo a big part of your summer? That's something you make sure you get to every year?
Yep, we always go to the zoo.
All right. Well, enjoy that trip this weekend, Molly. I hope you have good weather for the zoo visit.
Yeah, we were shooting to go to the Milwaukee Zoo, which is, I think, a fabulous zoo. Didn't get there yet, but maybe it'll be a fall activity. And we're going to move on to Colleen in Poinette. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing great. My end of summer plan is a get-together with a lot of old friends that I don't get to see very often, and they're coming out to my farm for a bonfire.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. An end of summer bonfire. You know what? The weather may just be, you know, chilly enough that that's kind of the perfect balance to go from season to season. So have fun with the bonfire.
Thank you.
Thanks, Colleen. We've got Ann on the line now in Waterville, Iowa. Ann, what are your end of summer plans? What are you trying to get done before fall rolls around?
What I'd like to get done is take my team of ponies out with their little wagon and go for a picnic drive, stop in a park, have a picnic, and then drive home.
And take us with you.
I was just going to say that. I want to go on a pony picnic.
Yeah. Where do we sign up?
Yeah. Take the Central
Time
team.
You got to come to Waterville.
Okay.
You got to come to Waterville.
Well, that sounds really tempting. Can
so
we get
far,
off?
You're winning, yeah. Can
Maybe
we get the day off?
Someone asked Cheryl if we can have off for the pony picnic. Well, that sounds really fun, and I hope you get to do that. I hope the weather cooperates. It sounds fantastic. And we're going to go next to Tim in Burlington. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hi there. What is on your summer bucket list?
I'd like to go scuba diving one more time before summer's over.
Where do you dive?
All over. Originally, when I was 19, I took all the lessons, and my car broke down on the last day when I was supposed to go for my final test, and I never figured I would pass it anyways. And about 30-some years later, I took the wife to Jamaica for her 60th birthday, and I took all the classes over again, and I got certified down in Jamaica, and now I'm one more certification, and I'll make Master Diver.
Perfect. Wow, that sounds pretty great. Yeah, one more scuba diving. It hasn't been the most, you know, swimmy of summers, and by that I mean it's been kind of cool, but do you wear a wetsuit every time you go so you're not chilly?
I wear a wetsuit, but you know, you can go ice diving too and wear a dry suit, and then you stay almost completely dry.
Mm. All right. Well, that sounds like fun, Tim. Thanks for telling us about it.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. I think the pony picnic sounds safer, though. I'll still stick with that. We are taking your calls asking how you are going to spend the last few days of summer before September rolls around, back to school. What is your end of summer must do? 800-642-1234 is the number. 800-642-1234. Reporter Maureen McCollum wants to get out on the Mississippi River as much as possible before it gets too cold. Maybe camp out on one of the sandbars. Good luck with that, Maureen. We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Jody on the line in Kaukauna. Jody, hi.
Hi. This is not a tradition. We actually have to get a house ready for sale in the springtime. And we're hoping to get the grounds ready so we don't have to do anything before the spring or after the spring comes. So that'll be a challenge to get it all done.
All right.
Do you think you can still do some planting and stuff before the colder weather hits?
Hopefully so. Obviously nothing that will bloom in the spring. Probably all the, I don't know, maybe tulips.
Tulips.
That would be nice.
There you go.
All right, Jody, off the phone and back to work. Good luck getting all that done.
All right, let's go to Jeannie and Racine. Hi there.
Hi. I'm going up to Madison this weekend to visit friends, and we haven't gotten up to the farmer's market at all this summer, and I really wanted to get there one more time before it's fall. And also we'll be going over to the American Players Theater in Spring Green on Sunday night.
Oh, great. What are you going to see?
See a play. We're going to see The Seagull.
The Seagull. Okay. I think that one's supposed to be good. Well, thank you, Jeannie. And, you know, the farmer's market, you can never hit that too many times in a summer, right?
Yeah,
except
definitely.
I haven't managed to go to the downtown one once this summer.
We made it to some of the other ones, though.
Yeah, I did. But we need to prolong summer. Clearly, all of these people are making me realize that I didn't do enough stuff.
We've wasted our summer. Michelle is with us next in Cross Plains. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
What's your plan?
So my plans on Monday with my family is to take my kids to the harness racing at the Iowa County Fair in Mineral Point. When I was young, my parents would take me, and we took our kids the first year last year, and they've been talking about it ever since. So we're excited to go check out the horse races and ride some rides, eat some fair food.
Wonderful. Michelle, thank you. And that's a more recent addition. I think the county fair or a state fair is a key to summer. I hit the Dane County Fair this year, and I was up in the UP. I hit the Houghton County Fair while we were up
nice.
There. Yeah, so I agree. County fair is essential.
Got it. Well, that sounds fantastic. And, you know, what about you, Rob?
So the Devil's Lake, I blew it. I've got a couple books that I was going to read this summer, but another one took me too long. So I'm gonna put that on the fail list. I don't know. It's a long litany of failure, Veronica. How about you?
I don't know. I think my summer's been a failure because I haven't gone on a pony picnic.
Yeah.
Now
the pony picnic wins.
I did go to a Brewers game.
That's a good one. Oh, Cynthia Schuster wanted to get to baseball game. She hasn't done that yet. All right. So a lot of great ideas to try to rush through this weekend.
Clearly, after last winter, we need a longer summer. That's my takeaway.
What's the government going to do about that?
Yeah. We'll talk about that next. No, we won't. We'll talk about something totally different.